Sponsorship for this KQED live audio stream comes from Brevo. Growing businesses can choose Brevo as their marketing platform to help cultivate lasting customer relationships. Learn more at brevo.com. That's brevo.com.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Health Dialogues. On today's show, medical mistakes. Hospital errors kill thousands of Californians each year. Deadly infections caused by dirty hands or equipment, mistaken prescriptions, even operating on the wrong body part. You can't eliminate human errors, but how can you reduce them?
The first thing we had to do was begin to approach medical mistakes in a different way, that they were not generally manifestations of bad human beings who are uniquely careless or stupid.
The medical profession is making changes, but what can consumers do?
One thing patients do is they don't think of doctors the same way they think of car mechanics, and they should. When you take your car into the shop, you ask tough questions, and you second guess, and you doubt, and you push back, and I think you should do that with doctors, too. I think that patients don't do that. They're intimidated.
I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is Health Dialogues. We'll get started right after this. And welcome once again to Health Dialogues. I'm Scott Schaefer. You know, there's an old joke that the last place you want to be if you're sick is in the hospital, the implication being that hospitals can make you sicker with unintended infections, mix-ups by doctors or nurses, and so on. Now, that, of course, is a huge exaggeration. Medical miracles occur every day in hospitals, lives saved, organs transplanted, diseases cured. And yet, according to our best estimates, medical mistakes cause 10,000 unnecessary patient deaths in California every year. And another 12,000 or so die from hospital-acquired infections. We'll get to what's being done about it in a minute, but let's begin with a first-person story.
My name's Dave Meyer. I live in Fair Oaks, California, and I was a general contractor before my accident. I was coming back from a friend's house, 11:30 at night. Everything was fine, and all of a sudden in the middle of the road is a black stretch limousine and another car with no lights on, and I had nowhere to go, and it was either go over or under, and I laid the bike down and slid right into the side of the limousine, and looked back at my ankle, and it was hanging backwards and dangling. I was taken to a hospital. I had a compound fracture. I had 10 pins and screws and straps to put my ankle back together. It never seemed to heal. And there was an infection that I got in the hospital. And the doctor noted at the time, he said, you know, this looks like it's infected. He said, look, come back in a day or two and we'll look at it again. And when I came back, he said, well, it looks kind of okay. And so he sent me on my way. And I didn't realize that I did have a MRSA infection, and I ended up having it for almost a year without knowing. Ultimately, I went to an orthopedic surgeon, and he looked at it and said, well, you know, maybe the reason that it's not healing is because of your hardware. Maybe it's irritating. So let's go in there and do another surgery on you and take the hardware out. I went through that whole surgery again, and then it still didn't heal. And at that point, he said, well, you know, gee, what we need to do now is we need to do a debridement. We'll just go in there and clean it up, he said. And what he called cleaning it up turned out to be, imagine taking an ice cream scoop and just taking half of your foot off. That's kind of the way it looked to me, just this gaping hole. So then we go through that debridement surgery, and I went into his office, and he was checking me. And he reached down into my open wound and started poking around with his finger. And I said, well, you know, shouldn't you have washed your hands first? And well, shortly after that, I got a new infection, one called Pseudomonas, which is very difficult to get rid of. Finally, I just said, you know, I've had enough of you. And so I went to see another doctor. If I could have just gotten the proper treatment in the hospital without the infections, it would have been so much easier for me to deal with this. I know that it would have been so much better if they would have just used the proper hygiene in the hospital.
And again, that was David Meyer describing his horrifying experience following a motorcycle accident near Sacramento in 2006. Joining us now is someone who helped shine a light on errors in the healthcare system. Dr. Bob Wachter is a professor of medicine at UC San Francisco. He's co-author of Internal Bleeding, The Truth Behind America's Terrifying Epidemic of Medical Mistakes. Dr. Wachter, good to have you with us.
Thank you so much. Nice to be here.
Let me begin by just asking you about what we just heard, David Meyer. How typical is that kind of experience?
It's not typical, but it happens. It happens too often. Patients come into the hospital with one problem and leave with another problem, an infection that we cause. Some of the time, it's not preventable, but too often it is preventable if people adhere to certain kinds of practices, hand hygiene, draping wounds the correct way. There are certain kind of simple things that we don't do with 100% regularity. And if we did, we would prevent a lot of infections.
And are those kinds of mistakes the most common when you look at the whole constellation of errors out there?
They are among the most common. The most common mistakes are communication glitches. I knew something about you when I was taking care of you in the hospital, and I didn't transmit that information correctly to your primary care doctor, and something got lost in the handoff. Infections are certainly in the top three of the of medical mistakes that lead to harm, and they certainly harm and kill hundreds of thousands of people a year. And I think one of the things that's relatively unique about infections is that we pretty much know how to prevent, not all of them, but most of them, if we did the right thing.
Well, and as we heard in that piece, something so obvious to almost anyone who works in a restaurant or just all of us, you know, as we go about our day, washing your hands.
Yeah. Yes. It turns out
that surgeons,
it is shocking. So it turns out surgeons are terrific at this when they are in the operating room. So you don't have to worry that when the surgeon is opening up your belly or your heart to do your surgery, the surgeon is not cleaning his or her hands for the requisite amount of time. What we're sloppy at is after you leave the operating room and you're on the floor of the hospital and doctors and nurses are coming in and out of your room all day long to examine you and talk to you. Most hospitals, when you looked at that rate, the rate with which doctors, nurses, and others clean their hands, about 10 years ago, it was 10 or 20% of the time they would do it. 80% of the time they would not. In good hospitals that have been working on this religiously, that rate is now up to 70 or 80%. It's still not 100. We have to have a little bit of sympathy because the average doctor, for example, on rounds, I may go in and pop in and see 20 patients in very rapid succession. And every now and then we'll forget, but we should get that one right close to 100% of the time.
Well, it's been 7 years now since your book came out. What do you think has changed in those 7 years?
I think we've made a fair amount of progress. The first thing we had to do was begin to approach medical mistakes in a different way, that they were not generally manifestations of bad human beings who were uniquely careless or stupid. They were mostly because we had very glitchy systems that didn't anticipate that human beings would blow it from time to time and catch those errors. And so the real solutions have been things like computer systems, have been double checks, have been the use of checklists, things that seem like no-brainers, but we didn't think to implement in healthcare, in part because we had this mental model that errors were about bad people, not about bad systems. So I think we've made some progress. If you come to UCSF today, you will. I have patients say to me, why is it that every single person asks me my name? Well, the reason is because we screwed that one up in the old days by not double-checking, triple-checking your name. We're much better at cleaning our hands. We have good computer systems, but we're still not perfect.
Does it seem that most mistakes are a result of a cascade of problems, not just one big catastrophic error, but sort of a series of things where the system failed? And you sort of alluded to that a moment ago.
That's what we've come to understand. And that's actually not unique to medicine. When you look at 9/11, when you look at the stock market implosions, when you look at BP and what happened in the Gulf, they almost always have the same pattern. You see the fingerprints of human errors. You see some person or people didn't do exactly the right thing. But when you sort of go to the wide-angle lens and you look at the whole picture, you see a system that was designed for failure, where it depended on people being perfect. And you can't do complex tasks and assume that you're going to have 100% reliability if you have human beings in the mix. And so that is the way errors happen. And I think it was only after appreciating that we began to think about how we design systems that catch the errors of human beings.
so many things nowadays are computerized, and I'm just wondering the extent to which you see technology as part of the solution versus part of the problem, or maybe a little of both.
And the answer is going to be both, of course. The it's part of the solution in that, for example, 5 years ago, an error might be because I wrote down a prescription in my not very good handwriting on pieces of dead trees, and someone had to read that and figure out whether I meant one drug or another drug that might have very similar names. That's a terrible system. Or that I would have to remember that these two medicines I'm giving you have an interaction with each other. And there are 10,000 medicines. I'm not smart enough, and no doctor's smart enough to remember that. So,
or you may not know that.
Or I may not know it, or it may have just come out in the literature a month ago and I haven't read it yet. So there are computers are clearly part of the solution, and systems that have advanced information technology systems have found significant decreases in certain kinds of errors.
Well, I want to play a short clip from an interview we did with a nurse. Her name is Deanne McEwen. She's been an ICU nurse in Southern California for many years. She's also co-president of the California Nurses Association. Let's listen to what she had to say, and then we'll come back and talk.
She was covering for a critical patient who needed emergency ventilation and life support. And so a physician asked her to set up for an emergency intubation, putting in an artificial airway. In order to do that safely, the patient has to receive a couple of different drugs, one for sedation, one then to paralyze the patient so they don't move and the airway can be placed safely into the proper location. In the course of opening the emergency tray, the particular RN injected a medication, epinephrine, that caused the patient's blood pressure to skyrocket. It was not the drug that the doctor ordered, which was Etomidate, which would have paralyzed and relaxed the patient for the procedure. And he said, "Are you sure you gave the right medicine?" She said, "Oh, yes." And she was looking at the monitor, and they were both looking at the reaction. He asked her to push another dose. She pushed another dose of the same medication again.
So, Dr. Walker, what are your thoughts about that kind of a scenario? And obviously, you'd need to know more about it.
But. Yeah. I mean, that sort of thing happens. It's rare, but it happens once is too often.
I want to point out, too, she was a floating nurse. And
right.
So she was called into this situation not as familiar with it as she might have been.
It demonstrates what one of the things that we do see that when we analyze terrible errors, we often see multiple small things that any one of which, if that was all that was wrong, might not have led to harm. But you see someone who's unfamiliar with that workplace, maybe doesn't know the equipment or, in that case, the medication tray quite as well, maybe overly busy, multitasking too many things on his or her plate. I would wonder – I didn't hear that in the clip, but I would wonder whether culture and hierarchies went into it. And by that, I mean sometimes you have a situation where a doctor is saying to the nurse, "I need this thing." The nurse suspects that something is wrong and yet doesn't feel comfortable speaking up to power. So I think that those are often when we analyze complex errors, we see there's all of those things embedded in the case.
Well, and one of the things in your book that stood out for me was the notion that the healthcare field could learn a lot from the aviation industry. And I think it's relevant to what you just said.
Yeah, I think some of the things that aviation has done extraordinarily well is that they have standardized everything. So a pilot or co-pilot walks into a cockpit of a 747, and they all look exactly the same. In this case, it may very well be that this particular tray looked very different than a tray that had the same name at a different hospital, for example. They have trained and in simulators, so they're used to those sort of circumstances over and over again. And very importantly, it's not just checklists and equipment, but it's also culture, that they have gone through teamwork training where they learn the importance of speaking up if they see something that seems wrong. What's not very important or interesting in error and learning about errors is what does someone do when they're sure something is wrong. What's really important is what does someone do when they're not sure it's right.
When there's doubt.
When there's doubt. And when we look at a lot of medical errors and analyze what happened, you see that there was someone or sometimes multiple people who had doubt and they had learned over the years just to blow it off.
You tend to focus on the system and not on the person, not blaming the person that made the mistake. And you've gotten some criticism for that. What's your response to why it isn't important also to root out the bad apples?
I think both are important, and I think the criticism's appropriate. I think in the early days of the patient safety field, we went from a notion that it's all about bad people. That's the way the malpractice system tends to frame the issue. It's a natural way for patients and frankly, for doctors to frame the issues. I think I thought about it that way myself. I made a bad mistake. How could I be that terrible? We came to recognize that that was largely wrong, that most errors are committed by good people and it is the system. And I think we went too far. I think we began to say it's always the system as if there's no such thing as a bad apple or no such thing as an act that really requires individual accountability. And I think 10 years into the safety field, we're reaching a more mature understanding. I think most errors are system problems, but there are some bad apples. We're not very good at identifying them and purging them. And I think something like hand hygiene that we started out with, at some point, the system's good enough and the right response is, you didn't clean your hands, we're going to do something to punish you.
A lot of doctors and physicians organizations, of course, they complain a lot about the malpractice system in California and in the country. How big a part of the problem do you think it is? Because it encourages physicians, for example, to practice defensive medicine or anything else.
I think the malpractice system is a bad system and it's pretty unfair. Having been expert witness in a number of cases, I've seen it from the inside. And it's pretty arbitrary. It doesn't even give patients what they need, which is since half of the money in a settlement often goes to the experts and to the lawyers, it doesn't work well on any level. I don't believe, however, that it's an important reason why care is unsafe. I think that it's almost unrelated to the safety problem. The one piece of it that is related is it does make doctors and other health professionals clam up. People, one of the things that we need to do in order to fix the problem of medical mistakes, something you're doing today, which is expose cases of medical mistakes so that we all learn from them and are comfortable teaching each other about what we learned from glitches and from harm that we caused. And if every time I think about writing something or in my own hospital talking about it, I have to worry in the back of my mind whether an enterprising lawyer is going to get a hold of it and sue me, I'm now reluctant to be as open as I need to be in order to fix the problem.
Is there a mistake you made in your profession that you can think of that stands out for you and that you really learned something about yourself and about the system?
I've made many. I'm not proud of any of them, but the one that stands out most is one I made as a medical student, which I think is evidence of something, another issue in healthcare, which is making sure that students and residents have appropriate supervision. That's something we work on quite a bit now. But I remember a patient who had recently had surgery. I came in to see him. He was in Philadelphia, and he was very, very short of breath, and he was panting like a dog and sweating. And I asked him what he thought was wrong, and he told me the room seemed kind of hot. And the room did seem kind of hot, and I said, okay, that sounds reasonable, not realizing that his symptoms were absolutely classic of having a big pulmonary embolism, a blood clot to his lungs after his surgery, and that it was classic, but I just hadn't read the chapter in the textbook yet to tell me that this was classic. And so I kind of made a note of it and said that I would tell my supervisor about this a couple hours later, and an hour later he was dead.
Hmm. So what does that tell you? I mean, students are students. They're going to learn, as things go on. What does it tell you about changing the system?
Well, it says something about this issue of hierarchies that I was uncomfortable admitting my ignorance. And if I was more comfortable with that, and I think our students would be today, I would have said to myself, I don't really understand what's going on with this patient. He tells me it's hot. It is hot, but I'm not sure this feels right. And I would have called my supervisor. But back then, I would have felt like I would be looking like I was dumb. And so that has to be fixed.
All right. Dr. Bob Wachter, he's a professor of medicine at UC San Francisco and co-author of Internal Bleeding, The Truth Behind America's Terrifying Epidemic of Medical Mistakes. Dr. Wachter, thanks for coming in.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
Earlier this year, California became the 28th state to require that hospitals tell the public how many people get infections while in their care. Patient advocates pushed for these laws out of frustration with hospitals and state regulators who said reducing these sometimes deadly infections wasn't really a priority. But does this kind of public shaming really work? Sarah Varney reports.
What's worse, losing face or losing money? That psychological quandary could be critical to ridding the nation's hospitals of avoidable infections like MRSA and other antibiotic-resistant bugs. Under a barrage of state laws and Medicare rules passed over the last few years, hospitals are now forced to report infections, risking their reputations as sterile sanctuaries, or refuse to comply and face financial penalties, all of which has left hospital administrators like Clark Todd of Pacific Hospital in Long Beach weighing the costs of fessing up with the costs of fines.
If we hide it from the public, then the tendency to keep the status quo is stronger than ever, and that's just not going to get the job done.
And there is a job to get done. As a result of infections from routine surgeries and everyday hospital care, like catheters that deliver food, water, and medicine to patients, some 100,000 people die every year in the U.S. Millions more are harmed.
You can't have this kind of rate of error in the airline industry, or you're shutting your doors. You're done.
Leah Binder is CEO of Leapfrog, a group of large employers that pushes for public reporting.
When a patient gets an infection in the ICU, it adds maybe $42,000 to the cost of their visit. That's just one individual. The costs to employers are enormous.
Those costs, in dollars and human lives, are largely avoidable, say federal health officials. Indeed, scores of hospitals across the nation have effectively eliminated infections. At Pacific Hospital in Long Beach, hand washing is so routine, the nurses complain their hands are chapped.
Hospitals are dirty. We clean very good certain areas. We wash our hands. We demand clean uniforms, but we don't clean the patients.
The hospital hired Dr. Alfonso Torres-Cook 5 years ago to bring down its infection rate. When he arrived, Torres-Cook says the medical staff viewed infections as largely unavoidable and treated them with antibiotics. Instead, under Torres-Cook's direction, nurses now wash patients every day. The air in the hospital gets cleaned using UV light, and janitors are given enough time to properly clean rooms. CEO Clark Todd was an early believer in publishing the hospital's infection rate, even before California law forced him to do so. But he says the public reporting laws and financial penalties from private insurers and Medicare have helped his cause.
I think that gives administrators like me even more reason to get involved in this matter and more clout with their medical staffs to work against some of these traditional behaviors.
Pacific Hospital's very low infection rate has no doubt caught the attention of competitors and potential customers, and it's become a source of pride for its employees. Indeed, researchers have found that concern over public image is a more powerful motivator than even fear of losing market share. One study of Wisconsin hospitals found public reporting spurred long-term quality improvements. In Pennsylvania, which has the toughest reporting law in the nation, infection rates have plummeted. Still, the stigma of infections and fear of lawsuits can make hospitals reluctant to report. When the law went into effect in California, 19 hospitals out of 400 didn't send in any data. At this point, state regulators aren't imposing penalties. There are other concerns. Competitors may undercount, making more honest players look bad. And some hospitals simply do more surgeries or have sicker patients.
It is absolutely true that the measures are not perfect and don't adequately account for some of the differences among patients.
The powerful hospital lobbying group, the American Hospital Association, supports public reporting, says Vice President Nancy Foster. But she says that alone won't stop infections.
What we know is that you need good science around what should be done for the patients.
There are proven techniques, for example, to prevent central line bloodstream infections caused by tubes inserted into large veins. But urinary tract infections, often caused by urinary catheters, are not as well understood.
We know one of the best things we can do is to get the catheter out of the patient as quickly as possible. But given the complexity of patients, it's not always possible to get the catheter out very rapidly. And so knowing how to prevent that infection when a patient has to have a catheter for a long time is really still science in the works. It is not yet a perfected system.
It will be some time before patients can know the full risk of entering their local hospital. Most states publish just a short list of infections. Even Medicare is starting off slow, asking hospitals to report only catheter-associated infections this year. Those that don't forfeit 2% in their reimbursements. For patients who come to the hospital hoping to get well, this double-barreled approach, public reporting and amped-up financial sanctions, may be the best cure for what has proven to be a chronic condition in hospitals. For Health Dialogues, I'm Sarah Varney.
To see photos of Sarah Varney's visit to Pacific Hospital of Long Beach and to see what they're doing to combat hospital-acquired infections, go to our website, healthdialogues.org. Coming up, how another hospital in Southern California is turning around a terrible record on patient infections. I'm Scott Schaefer, and you're listening to Health Dialogues.
There's lots of good information at healthdialogues.org, including links where you can research infection rates at hospitals near you. While you're there, check out our State of Health. Our blog features voices from people in communities all over the state, writing about health issues where they live. Learn about the threat to ambulance services in Imperial County and what the Southside Community Resource Center means to Oroville. That's all at healthdialogues.org.
You're listening to Health Dialogues. I'm Scott Schaefer, and this hour we're focusing on medical mistakes. And there is some good news on this front. The Federal Centers for Disease Control reports a 58% drop over the past decade in a particular kind of infection that happens in hospital intensive care units. Lauren Whaley with the Center for Health Reporting brings us a story from an Inland Empire trauma center that reported a very high number of these infections and is attacking them head on.
Okay, first of all, you wet your hands, then with a little amount of soap.
Sylvia Nass, an infection preventionist, is showing me how to wash my hands. Yes, you heard me. Wash my hands. It's at least 7 steps and takes almost a full minute.
Between fingers.
Backs of hands, special attention to the thumbs, and fingernails scrubbing palms.
And that's it.
Nass is the infection cop at Riverside County Regional Medical Center in Moreno Valley. She's originally from Argentina and has won awards on 3 continents for her work in preventing infections. She says simple protocols like vigorous hand washing can save lives.
I think everybody can do it. It's not a big deal.
But what hand washing prevents is a big deal. Nass oversees infection control for the whole 362-bed public hospital. When she started counting 2 years ago, she found that her ICU had one of the highest rates in the state for central line-associated bloodstream infections. These infections can happen when patients get their food and meds through tubes inserted into large veins, usually in their neck, chest, or groin. Bacteria can get into these tubes and cause nasty infections. Nationally, of patients who get these line infections, up to 1 in 4 die.
Our rates of infection were quite high, you know?
Nass recorded 50 line infections in her ICU in the first part of 2009. She wants that number at 0. She says it's important to remember the people behind these numbers.
Anybody can come to this hospital. It could be you, your family, your friend.
When we first started this project, there was some resistance from the staff that, you know, here's this person that's coming in and kind of looking over their shoulders.
Nurse Sue Henningsen is part of Nass's 3-person team. She helped Nass develop procedures to bring down infection rates. Henningsen focused on educating and monitoring the ICU staff.
If they look good, I look good, and the patient has a better outcome. So I think it's kind of a win-win situation.
The win-win doesn't come easy. But Nass and her team found inspiration in a well-known Johns Hopkins doctor named Peter Pronovost. He fights infections with checklists. The Riverside team designed its own checklist to make sure all staff members, from nurses to the highest paid surgeons, were completing basic steps like changing dressings, wearing gloves. The ICU is chaotic, crowded, noisy. it's easy to imagine that a hand wash could be skipped or a line left in longer than needed. Oversights that put patients at risk. But Henningsen and Nass try to make it easy to follow the rules. Docs are now required to assess every single day whether each patient even needs a line. Checklists hang on every door.
Having a quick reference like this readily available is very helpful.
Supply cabinets are brimming with protective gloves, gauze, and gowns. Henningsen lathers up before pulling on a pair of purple gloves.
If I'm doing multiple things, I may need to change gloves a few times if I'm going from one dirty site to another dirty site. And that's something that we've really had to keep reminding the staff about.
By sticking to the checklist, Nass and her team have reduced their numbers from 50 infections in early 2009 to only 17 for the first part of 2010.
I think it's good story, yes, but by the other hand, I think we need a lot of things to do yet. We still have to work.
Hospitals across the state could learn from Riverside County Regional Medical Center. When it reported higher than average infection rates, a small team made a big plan. And now, the numbers are going down. In Riverside, this is Lauren Whaley for Health Dialogues.
Lauren Whaley worked with her colleague Deborah Schock at the California Healthcare Foundation's Center for Health Reporting to bring us that story. You can see pictures of Lauren's trip to Riverside County Regional Medical Center at our website, healthdialogues.org. It's been more than a decade since the Institute of Medicine released a report showing that nationwide, more than 100,000 patients died each year from medical mistakes. That report helped launch the patient safety movement. I spoke with Betsy Imholtz of Consumers Union and William Heisel, a former investigative reporter with the Los Angeles Times and the Orange County Register, who now writes a health blog called Antidote. And I began by asking Betsy Imholtz what's changed in the years since that report exposed those problems.
Well, I think the main thing that's changed is people recognize that we do have a problem with medical errors and hospital-acquired infections. And laws have started to become enacted. I think the climate has changed in the sense that transparency of that information is more the norm. It's more expected. And we see both the state and federal government starting to kick in with some measures both on transparency and on reimbursement practices that penalize or adjust for medical errors and hospital-acquired infections.
In terms of changes to those numbers, translate into roughly 1 million Americans a decade. Have those numbers come down as far as you know, or is it really too soon to say?
Well, the sad truth is that we really don't know because the data is not well kept in California or nationally. But the estimates are that about 12,000 lives a year in California alone are lost just to hospital-acquired infections. So it's a big number, but it's kind of a guess because we're still perfecting the data.
And we don't know how well hospitals are actually reporting, so it may be underreported.
That's right. I mean, that's a big issue, which is a lot of this is self-reported and government short-staffed, and validating it is not always done.
And when you say transparency has improved, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think that the expectation increasingly is that we will have access to data. I mean, we're all going to be required to get health insurance in the coming years and to carry it. And I think it's only fair then that we have access to information to make good choices. And so I think government on all levels and many policymakers and some in the medical industry as well recognize that the age of transparency is here.
So, William Heisel, in the reporting you've done as an investigative reporter for the LA Times and what you're doing now for your blog Antidote, I'm just wondering what you feel is the perspective of hospitals in all this. Are they motivated to get to the bottom of it and fix it, or is there still, you know, kind of denial and even obfuscation in a sense?
I think there are two things going on. I think the hospital administrators are motivated. I think especially at the big centers, the very profitable centers, they are motivated. They want to be considered the best. They don't want to be a place where they're readmitting patients because they've made an error or they've sent someone home with an infection. They also, though, have these very powerful doctors groups, physician groups that they're dealing with who maybe don't want as much transparency as what Betsy's talking about. And you can kind of see the difference in what Medicare has done. They've set up a site where you can compare hospitals and you can see things like readmission rates for the hospitals. They have done the same thing for doctors. It's called Physician Compare, but you can't get those same types of details from the Physician Compare site because doctors have pushed back against that. So when you talk about hospitals, you have to just talk about the institutions and also all the people inside.
And as California goes, I know that you don't just focus on California by any means, but as California does go, do you have a sense that things are better here, worse, or about average?
I think in terms of transparency, things are better. I think people in California are fortunate to have some fairly successful regulatory agencies in cracking down on hospitals when they commit a pattern of errors, cracking down on physicians when they commit a pattern of infractions. I don't think that they're doing everything they could. No medical board or state licensing agency is doing everything it could, in part because of what Betsy talked about. There's the financing issues and staffing issues. But I think that you find a lot more information in California about your doctor and about your hospital than you do in other states.
Betsy Imhals, what would you say about California versus other states? What is your sense?
Yeah, well, I have a little different take, which is consumers unions worked on getting laws passed over the past 5, 6, 7 years on transparency. And while we've been successful in getting those laws enacted over time, getting them implemented has been very, very challenging.
And is that a matter of cost or people power? Why are they slow to be enacted?
Well, the implementation's been slow, I think, because of resistance both within the medical community and then also within the agencies, frankly, over the past couple years. We always think our big victory is getting the law passed, but it's only half the battle because if you can't get it implemented, what's the point? And these laws required transparency, for example, on hospital-acquired infections, on whether healthcare workers were vaccinated for flu, et cetera. And it's been a very prolonged process, many missed deadlines on getting the information public. It's getting better. They've started to get some reports out, but it's been very incomplete. And frankly, many hospitals are still not reporting at all or reporting incomplete data.
William Heisel, is it your sense that these problems tend to be sort of systemic at an institution, or does it vary widely within departments? What's your take on that?
I think both things can happen. I think you can have a culture within a department where things have clearly gone wrong for a long time and a lot of people have looked the other way. And also you can just have a center that hasn't been run very well, that has allowed itself to be staffed with subpar individuals, and they don't have the commitment to quality that you'll find at another hospital. A lot of times, though, you can have an excellent hospital, which will have a poor center. I mean, this happened a couple years ago with the University of California, Irvine, where the LA Times exposed a series of problems with its transplant center. Otherwise, the hospital had a lot of things it was doing right, but it was doing a poor job at transplants. Fortunately for Americans and people in California and elsewhere, you can see that data for yourself. You can see how successful a center has been with its transplant centers, and that's what the Times did. It dug into the data, and it found out UCI and some other centers were doing a poor job.
The cases of medical mistakes that tend to make the news, of course, are the sensational ones. A surgery that was supposed to be on the left knee and it was the right knee, or the wrong kidney being taken out, or something more dramatic, an instrument being left in a patient during surgery. Betsy Imhals, from your experience, are those the exceptions? In other words, when we talk about the whole universe of medical mistakes, are those relatively small percentage of the overall, or are we talking about more common mundane things that things like not washing your hands that lead to infections? And is that a much bigger problem?
Well, infections are a huge, huge problem. And you're right, hand washing, which we all take for granted, should be a expected procedure, is only followed about 50% of the time in medical settings, studies have shown. So infections are, I think, a much bigger problem than anyone realizes. But again, also at the top of the list of adverse events that the Department of Public Health collects, the top of that list is stage 3 and 4 bed sores in terms of the number of reports. And those are those really bad bed sores that go, right down to the bone.
And why is that a mistake as opposed to just neglect?
Well, the definition is adverse event, which is, you're right, it's not quite a mistake, but it's lack of care, lack of turning, lack of getting someone up to move around, that sort of thing.
But it would be included in those 12,000 or so mistakes.
No,
so to speak.
No, the 12,000 number that I gave of deaths was only...
That's deaths, strictly.
Deaths and only for hospital-acquired infections. That's infections alone. The estimates for... medical harm generally caused by the hospital, that's medical errors, infections, et cetera, is much higher, like 900,000 is the estimate.
In California
alone.
Yeah. William Heisel, what can patients do, what should they do, and their loved ones, people who advocate on their behalf, before they choose a doctor, before they decide to have a procedure, with regard to these kinds of issues? What should they be asking? Where should they be finding information?
Patients should all follow some basic checks. And one of the first things that a lot of patients don't do, I don't think many of them even check to see if the doctor's licensed. It sounds incredible, but patients are treated and are operated on by doctors who aren't licensed. They may be licensed in a different country. They may have been licensed at some point in the past, but they perhaps don't have a current license. I've written about these doctors. And one thing they do is they should check their state medical board site. Almost every state medical board at this point will at a bare minimum tell you whether the doctor's been licensed. From that point, you want to see if they've been disciplined before and what for. So the same state medical board should have records on whether they've been disciplined. You should request all records they have on the doctor. And then you should see if the doctor's certified. So if you're being treated for cancer, you want to make sure that the doctor is certified in oncology. If you're being treated for an orthopedic problem, you want to make sure that they're certified in orthopedics. You don't want a surgeon to operate on you if they haven't been certified in surgery. So for the certification, you would go to the American Board of Medical Specialties, which is abms.org. You can type in your doctor's name and find out if they're certified. You'll find a lot of them are not.
So it's not that they've lost their license, they just never had one? Or they're never certified?
They're licensed, but they're not certified.
Betsy Imholtz, anything you would add to that? What consumers should be on the lookout for, where they should get their information, the kinds of questions they should ask?
I would always recommend that people start by educating themselves. And Bill has given some ideas about doctors, and certainly the medical board information's there. But in California, we also have the California Compare site that the California Healthcare Foundation runs. It doesn't have every hospital in it, but it has a lot of them, and it has a lot of different conditions. You can search by location of the hospital, condition, the hospital name. Also, the best advice if you're going into the hospital is to bring someone with you. Have an advocate.
William Heisel, go ahead.
Well, I just want to add one thing. I think one thing patients do is they don't think of doctors the same way they think of car mechanics, and they should. They're really smart, highly paid car mechanics. And when you take your car into the shop, you ask tough questions, and you second guess, and you doubt, and you push back. And I think you should do that with doctors, too. I think that patients don't do that. They're intimidated.
Oftentimes what results from these kinds of mistakes is a lawsuit. And there's a lot of talk about tort reform. Are frivolous lawsuits a big problem in California, and is the law an ally of consumers in terms of righting a wrong?
Well, I'm afraid not. In California, we have a cap, $250,000 cap. It's been in place for quite some time. It's the kind of thing they're talking about doing on the national level to reform and take care of this terrible problem with medical malpractice and frivolous lawsuits. But in California, it's a hardship, actually, for many people, finding a lawyer who'll take their case and getting the full compensation that they really need and deserve.
And what kind of recourse is there other than a lawsuit?
Well, the Department of Public Health, the State Department of Public Health, does license hospitals and will take hospital complaints. So you can go to their website and look that up. And I would encourage people to keep good records and to write out the story because, you know, you'll try it with the State Department of Public Health. You can take it to the Accrediting Commission for the hospital as well. And to have all those facts laid out thoroughly will help you with anybody you try to tell your story to.
William Heisel, your series that you've done for your blog, Antidote, Doctors Behaving Badly, where did you get the idea for that?
When I was at the Orange County Register, I just started writing these short items about medical board records on doctors. And people just responded in droves and called and sent emails and couldn't believe that someone was finally writing about a doctor who'd done them wrong. So I thought there's clearly a lot of interest in this and something I continue to write about. But when I started working on this blog for the University of Southern California, I decided to revive the idea and with changing the focus a little bit, instead of it just being about the doctors, talking about where are the failures in the system and why didn't the hospital turn this doctor in? Why didn't the medical board do something about it? If the FBI was investigating this doctor, why didn't they tell some local agency or tell the medical board? So that's the purpose of it.
Betsy, how cooperative are physicians in all this?
It's a very odd thing, Scott. In most areas, people want to boast about how well they're doing. In this area, we found a lot of closing ranks and a lot of both with the hospitals and to some extent with docs not wanting to boast about how well they're doing. So we're at a very interesting moment, and I hope it'll turn in the right way that we'll all recognize that we just need to get the information out in the public realm and move ourselves forward. It's not about blame, but it is about having the public accountability.
When you say we're at an interesting moment, do you mean because of health reform and all the changes?
Well, health reform, this transparency movement that we've been talking about, these great laws on the books in California, a new administration, it's kind of a new day and an opportunity to really move us forward and have California lead the way.
All right. Betsy Imholtz, William Heisel, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We invited the hospital industry to respond to what Imholtz and Heisel had to say about infections and medical errors. I asked Debbie Rogers with the California Hospital Association how hospitals view this issue of medical mistakes and avoidable harm to patients.
Well, hospitals work hard every day to put systems and processes into place to prevent medical errors and harm to patients. This is a science that has been progressing in recent years, and certainly the Institute of Medicine's landmark report to Err as Human really made public both the challenges that hospitals face and the issues of public reporting.
Is it something that hospitals embrace with enthusiasm, or is it something that they just feel that they have to do because of the law and, you know, because of reporting requirements?
Hospitals absolutely embrace patient safety. That's the reason that hospitals exist, is to provide high-quality care for all the patients that we serve. I think it's more in the public light now because of those reports than it had been in the past. But this level of work has been going on for a long time in hospitals.
Despite that, it seems that there are still an awful lot of hospital-acquired infections, errors, mistakes, by some estimates, 900,000 in California alone, including, you know, about 12,000 deaths from just from hospital-acquired infections. Why is it still so high in spite of all the attention it's gotten?
When we look at hospital-acquired infections and we look at adverse events, we're now starting to publicly report and better quantify for the public what those events look like and the number of them. I don't know if it's higher than it was 20 years ago. I suspect that we've improved significantly, but we never reported them in the past. So it's hard to make a comparison, you know, compared to 20 or 30 years ago where we were. When we look at the complexity of patient care, it's delivered by our hospital staffs who do the best every day. We have systems in place to prevent these errors, but sometimes a human mistake is made.
I wonder if you could react to one of the things our previous guest said, which is that among the obstacles to implementing those laws, the reporting laws in California, is resistance from the healthcare industry, including physicians groups and hospitals. What's your reaction to that?
That's an interesting question. You know, the California Hospital Association, we were in favor of the adverse event reporting bill, SB 1301, that was enacted several years ago, where hospitals now report the adverse events that happen in their hospitals. We worked very hard with the hospital-acquired infection bills. We were actually neutral on the public reporting bills, and that was due to other things in the bill related to retesting patients for MRSA and some other issues that were in the bill. But hospitals have supported the valid and reliable public reporting of hospital-acquired infections for quite some time.
Some who study this say that one of the problems is that there's a hierarchy, say, in surgery, and that nurses and others who are in the operating room feel reluctant to challenge or question a surgeon, for example, because of that hierarchy that, you know, doctors are at the top. Is that a problem, do you think?
Hospitals work on what we call the culture of safety. How empowered does any level of the staff feel to intervene if, for example, a checklist isn't being followed thoroughly, and feel empowered to report unsafe events. This is something that hospitals have been working on for quite some time. We have a number of staff that contribute to the patient care of every patient that we serve. Every one of those staff members needs to feel empowered to question, are we doing this in the right way? Are we doing this according to hospital procedure?
Some of the more extreme things we hear about medical errors are not the typical things, you know, a surgeon operating on the wrong knee or something like that. That's sensational, but it's not typical. I wonder if you could respond to what Betsy Imholtz from Consumer Reports said, which is that there was a study showing that just simple hand washing by medical personnel in one study that was only followed half of the time. Something so basic, so simple, so common sense, and yet half the time clinicians and others in a hospital setting just didn't wash their hands.
You know, in one of the hospital-acquired infection bills, actually, we asked that the law include that hospitals perform hand hygiene surveillance in their hospitals because we understand that hand hygiene is so important. Studies have shown that there are problems with some healthcare providers not washing their hands as much as they should. It's something that's being worked on.
I wonder what your thoughts are about what we heard earlier in the program, that some hospitals, although there is this reporting requirement, that not all hospitals do fully report or their reports are incomplete or inaccurate. What is the CHA doing to encourage all hospitals to fully report these infections and do it, do it accurately and in a timely way?
Well, CHA's reached out to the hospitals that the department gave us a list of the hospitals who've not reported their hospital-acquired infections. We've reached out to those hospitals to help make sure that they understand the requirement and get them the assistance that they need to technically report the infections.
When you say you reached out to them, what do they say? I mean, what's their explanation for not complying with the law?
You know, the law, in some ways, the direction from the department has been a little bit confusing. Initially, when hospitals began reporting hospital-acquired infections, there was two ways to do it. One of them was on paper, and the hospitals would fax in the information to the department, but there was never a receipt for the information, or it was a little bit looser system, if you will. Beginning in April of 2010, the department set the requirement that hospitals are required to use the national database. And the national database comes with national standards. So we're confident that moving to that system is going to ensure that hospitals are reporting valid and reliable data because it's all going through the same system.
All right. Debbie Rogers with the California Hospital Association. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Scott.
And that's all the time we have for this edition of Health Dialogues. But before we leave, a word about the future, or I should say, our future. For the past 11 years, Health Dialogues has examined a very wide range of health issues facing Californians. It's been our privilege to bring you stories from across the state, from Del Norte County to San Diego, San Francisco to Fresno, and everywhere in between. This will be our last hour-long broadcast, at least for now. But we'll continue in-depth health reporting that you can still hear on the California Report, carried on most of these stations, and online at californiareport.org. We also hope you'll check out our blog, which also continues. It's called Our State of Health, and it features voices from communities all over the state writing about health issues where they live. You can read about the threat to ambulance services in Imperial County, the health effects of living near the Port of Oakland, and what the Southside Community Resource Center means to the residents of Oroville. That's all at healthdialogues.org. You'll also find lots of information about the March program and all our past shows, including photos and extended interviews, along with links to this topic and many others. Again, you'll find it all at healthdialogues.org. Health Dialogues is a production of the California Report and KQED Public Radio. The director is Susie Racho. Seal Muller is our engineer. The Health Dialogues team includes senior online editor Gabriel Cohen, web producer Nick Vidinsky, and outreach coordinator Shuka Kalantari. The senior producer is Polly Stryker. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Reports Health Dialogue series are provided by the California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health begins. More information at calendow.org and the members of KQED Public Radio.